Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting in the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. The time is 2:01 p.m. We're in Belt's Room 105 at the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful and snowy capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Monday, March 16th, 2026, also known as St. Urho's Day. Members present are Senator Dunbar, Senator Yunt, Senator Gray Jackson, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Senator Merrick is up in Senate Finance and is excused for today. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Welcome everyone to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please turn off or silence your cell phones and join me in welcoming our recording secretary, Carrie Tupo, and our LAO moderator, Doug. We have four items on our agenda today. Under bills previously scheduled or heard, we have Senate Bill 249, Virtual Currency Kiosks, Senate Bill 226, Homemade Food Reduced Oxygen Packaging, Senate Bill 111, Digital Product Repair, Senate Bill 185, Insurance Rebates and Advertising. For those of you following along at home who want to know Doug's last name, it is Bridges. Thank you for being here today. First up, we will take up Senate Bill 249, brought to us by the Honorable Senator Kathy Tilton. This is our third hearing on the bill. In previous hearings, we heard a presentation of the bill. We took invited and public testimony, and members have a proposed draft committee substitutes in their packets for a consideration. Today, it is my intention to have committee discussion on our options on this bill and look to the will of the committee. Senator Tilton has not joined us so far, but we will move forward as we have many items to consider today. We have on the phone for consideration, we have Dan Fleer from the Division of Banking Securities, Tracer Reno from Banking and Securities, as well as Nathan Bucknell from Public Safety in Anchorage. Are there any questions for any of those folks or questions for a committee discussion? Seeing, hearing no questions, the committee substitute that we can consider today is a committee substitute that would effectively not allow cryptocurrency kiosks to operate in our state. Through the two hearings that we have had, we have heard many accounts of these kiosks being used for fraud. We saw a presentation that over 95% of all transactions using these kiosks in a state like Iowa were fraudulent. Over 95%. Less than 5% of all times that people used a cryptocurrency kiosk was for a legitimate purpose. We had, I personally since had a conversation with a lawyer from CoinFlip where we had an interesting and engaging conversation where she spent quite a good deal of time trying to portray that these transactions were reversible and that they could figure out, how to get money back to people if it was their first time as a customer. However, when I subsequently asked her, how is it that you can connect the identity of a person using a cryptocurrency kiosk with the money that – with the wallet that they are putting money into, her answer was that they cannot and no one can. So they can't verify who owns and controls the wallet, the virtual wallet that these people are putting money into, and no cryptocurrency company can. And I thought that was pretty shocking and telling that there's not a way to track who is receiving this money. As we have seen the pictures and kind of from these kiosks of the people who are really being duped by a scammer on their phone, being given a PIN and codes to put money into a virtual wallet where nobody knows who owns it. It's untraceable because of the blockchain analytics that are really the purpose of cryptocurrency. So we do have someone online that's not muted. Okay. Or maybe someone's just eating chips. That's which is fine. Chips are good. I like chips. No problem.
Do you have somebody you want to call?
No, but we're getting noise from somebody. So that's an option, is a committee substitute to just simply ban cryptocurrency kiosks. Another option is we could adjust through conceptual amendment on page 7 of the bill, we could adjust the limits down further so that we could further protect the public and to make sure that these kiosks are not being used for fraudulent activity. It was testified to that through some of these companies that are erecting and engaging in cryptocurrency kiosk business that the limits proposed in the bill would be such a disincentive that they would not be able to operate under those environments. However, that's not my intent. The intent that we have limits in place is simply for consumer protection. It is to protect the Alaskan people from not being taken advantage of by these cryptocurrency kiosks, which are used over 95% of the time for fraudulent activity in the state of Iowa, who's tracked these things. So another option might be to adjust these limits. On page 7, line 13, we could reduce that limit from 1,000 to 500 per day in transactions, and then monthly transaction would go from 10,000 to 5,000. And then we could cut the transaction fees from 3% to 2% or 1.5%. We heard testimony from a cryptocurrency business outside of the state that Alaska would be tied for the lowest cap at 3. We can win this one. We can win. We can move that cap from 3 to 2 if we want to. So what I'd like to do today is take some time to consider the proposed committee substitute, which would just ban the kiosks, or we could adjust the limits, or we could do nothing. And we could move the bill on to the next committee of referral as it is. Does anyone have any comments or questions? Senator Yunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some comments about the consumer protection side of that, of this legislation. It's important to me that we do something to protect consumers, but I think there's two different sides of this. There's the side that chooses to use these things over and over and over and over, possibly to buy cryptocurrency or whatever it may be. I would be less concerned about what the rate is, whether we're talking 3%, 5%. Most state caps, I believe, are 15 to 18%. You know, you're choosing to do that. They do that over and over and over. That's on them. That's more of a free market thing. But then back to the other side of the consumer protection side of things is the people that are getting hit with fraud in most cases are first-time users. They're at least that's what I was reading and I'm hearing is nobody uses this on the third or fourth or fifth try and gets hit with fraud. And so my understanding is many states are adopting policies where a first-time user is very limited to how much they can do per day, but then maybe someone who's established could do a lot more because they might actually be buying cryptocurrency, and in which case they would need to use a larger amount of money, if that makes sense. And so I think we should take those things into consideration as we move along. That's it. Thanks.
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, thank you for your recommendations, or maybe suggestions are a better choice of words. But I think that we should not be moving forward with a committee substitute that bans these kiosks because, you know, based on the letter or the information we got from legal, we could really be setting ourselves up for a lawsuit. And I don't think we really want to put ourselves in that position. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think a couple of important points about here and about the committee substitute. What we are not doing or proposing to do is ban cryptocurrency. Cryptocurrency would still be very much available in Alaska. I think a number of us in the legislature, including myself, own some cryptocurrency. It's not difficult to acquire. But I think there's sort of a misconception about what these kiosks are. They're referred to by some folks as a sort of a crypto ATM, but it's not what it is, right? An ATM, you get the currency out of the machine, if you will, and it goes to the person who is there at the machine. If there were a way to structure these kiosks so that someone could register their wallet with the kiosk and then purchase cryptocurrency for themselves and for their kiosk, for their own wallet, after having voluntarily, you know, registered said wallet, then there'd be no concern. But that's not what's happening here. What we've created with these kiosks is sort of frictionless way to take usually U.S. dollars and other currency and transmit it. It's more like a wire service than it is a traditional ATM to other wallet holders who are not registered and are untraceable. And it makes it incredibly easy to do fraud or other kind of illicit activities. I mean, things like human trafficking, drug dealing, those are also very much assisted by the untraceable nature of cryptocurrency and by machines like this that don't require any prior registration or positive identification before they're used. So I would support the committee substitute. However, if the committee decides to go forward, and I'll say that we are not the first state to consider this or do it. I believe the state of Indiana has already banned these machines. And again, you can still purchase cryptocurrency in Indiana, just like you would be able to purchase it here. Cryptocurrency itself is not an issue. It's these particular machines. But either way, I hope we advance some version of this bill to the next committee of referral relatively soon, whether it's a committee substitute or the original version, because I do think this is a problem that is ongoing, and I hope we can deal with it or at least help deal with it this session. I don't think we want to wait until next year, because people are being defrauded at a tremendously high rate. So those are my comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. Anything further on our options? Senator Merrick just joined us at about 2:10 p.m. Senator Yunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm not exactly Mr. Technology. This isn't my area of strength, right? Listen to, Senator Dunbar, it almost sounds like an untraceable Western Union, mm-hmm. if that makes sense, right? So Western Union has always been there for people when they're in a tough situation or whatever, need to send money to family or friends or whoever it may be, but this isn't traceable at all. So you'll be curious to see where this goes. And I did not realize that the fraudulent activity rate was so high. And so you're saying, Mr. Chairman, that the state of Iowa has been tracking this and then –
Yes, sir. Yep, we had a presentation on Friday from AARP, and they used the state of Iowa as an example in their presentation, which is the slides of that are in the documents on BASIS, where the fraud rate for all transactions used on crypto kiosks was well over 90% fraud.
Ouch. And is there any way, do we have any statistics for the state of Alaska in our limited time and limited use of these yet? Or I imagine it's very high. I'm just asking.
We could chat. We have Nathan Bucknell with us. He could speak to us kind of what they are seeing as from a public safety perspective. Mr. Bucknell, would you mind opining on what you feel the percentage of transactions that are fraudulent on cryptocurrency kiosks might be?
Yes, sir. Through the chair, for the record, my name is Nathan Bucknell. I serve as sergeant for the Department of Public Safety. Our experience is that of the reported scams, about half of them tend to deal with cryptocurrency. And of the ones that we're seeing, primarily most of the transactions on these ATM kiosks are fraudulent.
Thank you. So the kiosks are accounting So you have crypto is accounting for half of the scams, and your feeling is that most of them that happen on the kiosks, most transactions on kiosks are fraudulent?
Yes, sir. That's our experience here.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I agree that we may have some instances where there's legal question around banning these kiosks. I think that there are certainly a good reason to do that. I understand the apprehension from some folks that, you know, are concerned about the Dormant Commerce Clause provisions that were written to us in a legal memo. However, I really feel that there is no good reason to have these in our communities. And if people aren't comfortable with banning them yet, I totally understand that. For that reason, I would like to offer a conceptual amendment 1 to the bill, and that would revise the numbers on page 7 of the bill. So conceptual amendment number 1 will deal with page 7. Conceptual amendment number 1 changes the amount of 1,000 to 500 on line 13. Changes the number 10,000 to 5,000 on line 16. And moves 3% transaction fee on line 23 to 2%. Is there any objection to conceptual amendment number 1? Hearing and seeing no objection, conceptual amendment number 1 is adopted. Is there any further discussion on Senate Bill 249?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly. So obviously we did not move the CS, the ban, and we have before us this amended version. I'll say that while I did not oppose the amendment to change the numbers, to me it doesn't really get to the heart of the issue. And if there are kiosk operators now who are listening, who are wondering how they might be able to revise these machines in such a way where they would not in the future be at risk of being banned. And perhaps it's not financially possible. Perhaps they, like certain irresponsible alcohol operators who rely on alcoholics to stay in business, not all but some. Similarly, perhaps their business model can't work unless they have the fraud. I hope that's not the case. And if it's not the case, then my suggested reform is to goes back to the discussion that myself and Senator Yunt was having, turning these things more into something like an ATM and not a Western Union, as Senator Yunt said, because that's what they are now. They are ways to do transfers to wallets that are unregistered, so usually not wallets owned by the person who is depositing the cash. If these were machines where people could purchase cryptocurrency for themselves in a pre-registered wallet, that so that they knew who, so that the companies knew where that money was going, then I think there'd be no issue here. But that is not how this business is currently structured. Right now, it is not an ATM. It is a wire transfer service, and that is what is making it so open to fraud. That being said, I respect the work that Senator Tilton has done on this bill and yourself as well, Mr. Chairman. I particularly like the provisions here that require the operators repay fraudulent transactions. I believe that if they are held accountable for this behavior, they will make changes and reforms on their own to reduce this kind of fraud. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will support the bill as revised. Thank you.
Senator Yunt.
If the goal, thank you, Mr. Chairman, if the goal is to ban them and avoid a potential lawsuit, as mentioned earlier, I think this effectively does it. right? And so, and I didn't object. You know, I don't understand these very well, but hearing one of our own sergeants speak to the fact that it's mainly fraud that's occurring, Iowa, the state of Iowa is tracking this already. you know, if you're going out and buying crypto and you're a regular crypto investor, I don't think you're going to pay a 15 to 18% commission to buy and then a 15 to 18% commission to sell. Nobody in their right mind would do that, right? So they're charging wire transfer type fees to feed people that have to use them every once in a while in a short-term pinch or whatever it may be. And so, but with that being said, there's no way that the operator or of the kiosk could ever stay in business at a 2% or 3% rate. I mean, they have overhead, they have costs, they have things they have to do to stay in line with the federal regulations and state regulations. So there's no way they could operate at that level. And so, but also it probably takes away a potential lawsuit. The amendment stands. It'll move to the next committee. And I think if this legislation were to become law, we would probably not have any of them left in our committee or communities within a matter of weeks. So I'll leave it at that.
Let me take a brief eddies.
Brief eddies. We're back on the record now. It is 2:26 p.m. here in Belts, room 105. Are there any further questions, comments, committee discussion on Senate Bill 249? Hearing and seeing none, what are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move to report Senate Bill 249, version 34-Lima-Sierra 1465-A as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note, further moving to grant legislative legal the authority to make technical and conforming changes to the bill when drafting the final version.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, Senate Bill 249, version 34-LS-1465, as amended, version A as amended, is reported from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. We further grant legislative legal the authority to make technical and conforming changes to the bill while drafting the final version. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork and set up for the next bill. We're back on the record now. Next up is Senate Bill 226. With us to present the bill, we have the Honorable Senator Kathy Geisel and her staff, Samantha Freeborn. Thank you for joining us at Senate Labor and Commerce today. Will you please put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Kathy Geisel. I represent the Senate District E as an eagle. Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 226 relates to safe homemade foods for sale. It's a modification of some previous provisions that were made for the homemade food industry. It's a very simple bill, Mr. Chairman. It makes only a small adjustment, but it has serious implications, serious preventative implications related to the current laws. So it separates high botulism risk foods from the foods that qualify for Alaska's homemade food exemption. It requires that these high-risk foods be subject to appropriate food oversight, safety oversight by the Department of Environmental Conservation. It does not eliminate or broadly restrict the homemade food industry. The vast majority of those products are unaffected by this. This is a very small, focused change. Botulism is one of the most lethal poisons known to humans or animals. It causes muscle paralysis, which of course results in suffocation and fatality. The symptoms typically occur 18 to 36 hours after consumption, but may be delayed up to 10 days. Alaska has one of the highest botulism rates in the U.S., sometimes even up to 50% of the national cases in a single year. Between 2017 and 2024, we had 24 cases of foodborne botulism in Alaska. Low-acid foods are the culprit, Mr. Chairman. These are meats, vegetables, and products containing those items. They present a serious botulism risk when they're vacuum sealed or canned So in an anaerobic or without oxygen atmosphere. This includes homemade soups, preserved in jars, and meat jerky stored in vacuum-sealed bags. Currently, these at-risk foods are sold as non-potentially hazardous with no oversight, including by third-party agents such as cafes and grocery stores. Remaining unaffected by this bill are things like jams, jellies, pickles, preserves, bread, baked foods, salads, kombucha. These are the kinds of things you'll see at, of course, farmers' markets. This bill is a very small modification to address these botulism potential foods, homemade foods, basically to protect Alaskans, shield small and local businesses from economic and legal fallout for a single botulism case, and reduces costly state agency response. It supports a thriving homemade food culture. Mr. Chairman, the bill has a zero fiscal note. It would cost nothing to implement. For a sectional, it is a very short bill, but my staff, Samantha Freeborn, can take you through a sectional, Mr. Chairman. We also have an expert witness in the room, Sarah Lewis, who is a professor of Extension Health, Home, Family, and Community Development at the University of Alaska Cooperative Extension Service.
Thank you very much, Senator Giesel. Ms. Freeborn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Samantha Freeborn, staff to Senator Giesel. Section 1 amends the exemption for homemade food statute. This section adds potentially hazardous homemade food and low oxygen packaging to the list of foods that cannot be sold at any location. Section 2 adds a new subsection to the management and responsibility statute by adding a definition of reduced oxygen packaging, meaning a packaging method that removes oxygen to create a vacuum seal or preserve quality.
Thank you very much. This time, I'd love to have your invited testifier come forward.
Thank you.
Ms. Lewis, thank you for joining us today at Senate Labor and Commerce. If you could please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony, that would be most excellent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Lewis. I am a professor of extension with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Cooperative Extension Service. I'm in the Health, Home, and Family Development Program for Southeast Alaska. So my region is all of Southeast under normal circumstances, but when it comes to food entrepreneurship, I'm actually the HHFD, Health, Home, and Family Development specialist throughout the state. So I talk with people throughout the state regarding food entrepreneurship and most specifically homemade foods. So I do a lot of work related to homemade foods. I receive multiple calls a week. I do free consultations with people who are starting up or wanting to start up a homemade food business, talking about the regulations, because the regulations that were passed about 2 years ago are much broader than they were prior to that. And so there's lots of questions about food safety, about what is allowed, what is not allowed, what happens, if someone becomes sick, all kinds of things related to homemade food businesses. I support the changes proposed in this bill because there are three groups really that are definitely affected by this. Protecting consumers is, of course, very important. As you heard from Senator Giesel, who I thank very much for inviting me today, botulism poisoning is rare, but it's a very high health burden. And damage and very high medical cost, as well as cost to anybody who has to, including the state, who has to reply to that situation. Homemade food businesses also, though this change minimally limits the foods that they can offer to the public, in fact, one of the ones that Senator Giesel brought up was that this would limit selling, for example, beef stew in a jar that has been canned, but it does not limit selling that beef stew fresh, frozen, or refrigerated. It's only in that one circumstance, in the low oxygen packaging. And so it significantly actually reduces their liability exposure, because botulism is so very dangerous that if it does happen, that could be completely disastrous for a small business that may actually not even have liability insurance, because none of that is required under this. And the responsibility of knowing whether your food is dangerous is up to the producer of the food. There's no oversight at all. I am one of two primary sources of information for folks about the regulations and about food safety, DEC. I work closely with DEC, but I am from the education side and give lots of information that they don't necessarily have the staff to assist with. And then it was also brought up, of course, that the potential cost to the state. When there is a botulism outbreak in any location in the state, it is one that requires, my understanding, someone else might be able to speak to this more knowledgeably, but it requires a significant response, public safety and public health response and epidemiology. And because it is, when it happens, it's one that they need to make sure that it's not going to be an outbreak rather than just a single case, et cetera. So I am in support of the changes in this bill and would be pleased to answer any questions should you have any.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lewis. Any questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, we have online available for questions Louisa Castrodale from the Infectious Disease Program at the Department, Division of Public Health, as well as Shondi Perry from Environmental Health at DEC. I'm curious for either one of these professionals. Ms. Castrodale or Ms. Perry, have we seen a botulism outbreak from these types of homemade foods before in Alaska?
Through the chair, this is Louisa Castrodale, Division of Public Health. We, for the most part, the cases of botulism that we've seen have been with traditionally prepared Alaska Native foods. We have had a situation with a person who was home canning salmon that they had caught, and that's actually put together, or it's sort of described in an epidemiology bulletin, and that person became ill with botulism. But for the most part, the cases of botulism that we do see are from the traditionally prepared food. Thank you.
Understood. Okay. Thank you. Any further questions or comments? Senator Giesel, anything on wrap-up before we set this bill aside?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very well. Unless we have other concerns expressed about Senate Bill 226, likely we'll bring this bill up again this week under bills previously heard. It's pretty simple. I think we could probably keep it moving. So unless folks have concerns or any amendments, please let me know within the next couple of days. If I don't hear anything, we'll probably bring it up if Wednesday if we have time or Friday. We will roll right into Senate Bill 111. Senate Bill 111 is Digital Right to Repair, brought to us by the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee's very own Senator Forrest Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the interest of time, I'll keep my own remarks fairly quick. We have invited testifier in the room who's traveled to be here, and another invited testifier online who I hope the committee gets a chance to hear from. I think every member of this committee, except perhaps you, Mr. Chairman, have already heard a presentation on this, and I know that you are also fairly familiar with this bill. SB 111 is a digital right to repair. Manufacturers these days, some manufacturers, are deliberately creating additional obstacles to owners or independent repair technicians to repair their devices. In some cases, they refuse to publish documentation. They use proprietary tools. They glue parts together. This is an increasing problem with a lot of our goods that now contain digital components. Over the interim, we in the legislature received a petition with almost 1,000 signatures. There were more than almost 300 postcards sent in on this issue. I think it's an issue that's growing in importance because of the increased valence of these items. And with your indulgence, Mr. Chair, I would also ask that my staffer, Mr. Halen Benkin, present the changes that have happened in this bill in the prior committee rather than going through a sectional, if that pleases the chair.
Absolutely, it does. Mr. Benkin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Halen Benkin, staff to Senator Dunbar. The changes made to this bill, there are three. The first one, parts pairing prohibited, is under section 45.45.820. This bans the practice of linking two components of a device together with software. The effect of this is that if you swapped, for example, the camera module from two identical phones from one to the other, neither phone would function because the module has been linked via software to the motherboard of the phone that it was installed in. This is an entirely artificial barrier to repair that some manufacturers engage in, and this provision would ban it. The second change made is a provision for dealers of power sports equipment in section 45.45.840. This change accounts for the business model of the power sports sector, where all distribution of the original equipment as well as all support is done through a dealership, and this provision allows those dealers to take a markup on the provision of parts, tools, and documentation rather than being forced to do it and not making any money from it. This was requested by many of the dealers and is similar to a provision that already existed for agricultural equipment. The final change made was under section 45.45.895, where we added a complete exemption to this bill for medical devices. This was done because there is very little demand for owners or independent shops to repair medical devices. The liability and safety concerns are too great, and there is a very legitimate concern that a misconducted repair could not be noticeable until it caused bodily harm to a person. Thank you. Those are all the changes to the bill.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if it pleases the chair, I'll step back onto the dais so that our invited testifiers could come to the...
Yes, that would be most excellent. Very good. We'll go first to testimony in the room. Ms. Deani Chapman, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. We're glad you're here. Please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Great. Thank you so much to the chair. My name is Deani Chapman, for the record. I'm the State Director of Alaska Environment. We are a statewide environmental advocacy group that works on issues relating to clean air and water, open space. I'm going to start with just sort of the basic background. So as Senator Dunbar said, many manufacturers of electronics, and this ranges from consumer goods like cell phones to appliances like dishwashers to heavy machinery like tractors, often monopolize access to spare parts, tools, software, and schematics necessary to repair equipment. And this can play out in a range of ways. One example is a manufacturer using a unique screw head to open something like a battery compartment. If a repair shop or a handy individual doesn't have that screwdriver, they won't be able to change out the battery or even necessarily get access to that battery. Sometimes it happens through software restrictions. For example, many new tractors run on computers, and when something breaks, it will put the tractor in what's called limp mode, where power is limited just to make it so you can move the machinery off the field, but you can't continue to use it. And then even after you fixed what caused it to go into limp mode, you need software to turn limp mode off. And oftentimes people who operate heavy machinery are capable of making many of those simple repairs. And so it's pretty absurd that they would need software to be able to then continue to use the device. Limited access to schematics can force consumers into larger and more expensive fixes. So if a repair technician has that schematics for a piece of equipment, then they can know which fuse does what. Then sometimes a simple soldering fix can solve the problem for pennies rather than replacing an entire motherboard or a larger component in the device. These limitations mean that for many repairs, the only option is to go to an authorized repair provider, and that can play out in a couple ways. Oftentimes, they charge enough to make it prohibitive and inspire the person to just buy a new product instead. And then here in Alaska, we have very limited access to authorized repair providers. We released a report in the spring of 2025. And at the time, more than a third of Alaskans lived more than 100 miles from an authorized repair provider of Apple products. 100% of Alaskans lived more than 500 miles from an authorized repair provider for Samsung telephones. More than a third of Alaskans lived more than 100 miles from an authorized repair provider of LG appliances. And 100% of Alaskans lived more than 500 miles from a Maytag service provider, which does a lot of appliances. And there's a couple different things that happen when repair options are restricted. I'll start from the environmental issues as an environmental advocacy organization. Electronic waste, or e-waste, is the fastest growing waste stream in the world. And we wish recycling was more prevalent, but in 2022, only 22.3% of e-waste was collected for formal recycling and actually recycled, because it's challenging to separate out the non-recyclable components from the valuable minerals, and it can be dangerous. When we throw electronics away, toxic chemicals can get into our water, soil, and air, and folks processing electronics are exposed to lead, mercury, arsenic, and other chemicals that can cause risk for cancer, miscarriages, and neurological damage. In Alaska, most of our rural landfills are unlined, and many of them burn to reduce volume. So when you have electronics in those landfills, it can cause even bigger problems for people and wildlife, and that will just increase as permafrost melts. And then in landfills that are lined, it can still cause risk of fire, which can cost a lot of money for the state and for communities. So continued use is safer, and that means that repair is pretty essential. The other thing is that when things break quickly and we can't fix them, we often have to buy new, which also has a significant pollution component. The average person in the United States is buying a new phone every 2 to 3 years, a new computer every 4 to 5 years, new appliances every 10 to 15 years. And new electronics require minerals and energy to produce. The minerals we mine are valuable and come with a cost, and it is poor stewardship to treat them as disposable and throw them away after just a couple years of use. There's also financial impacts to limiting repair. Poor repair access just makes life more expensive for Alaskans. We obviously have a markup on everything, and the more rural you get in the state, the bigger that markup is, and most of that comes down to shipping. Along with cost, the time that it takes to get something new can be just as big of a problem. I talked to a woman in Kodiak a little while ago, and she had a washing machine break, and it took her 3 months to get it replaced. And regardless of where people live, it's a financial hit to buy something new and then have to replace it instead of fixing it when it breaks. A couple years ago, we did a study, and repair would save the average family in Alaska an average of $382 per year just on consumer electronics. And then our bill is broader than that, and it will make an even bigger impact on Alaskans who rely on off-roading vehicles, heavy equipment, snow equipment, and other electronics that we've added digital components to. There's also a local resiliency component. We have many independent repair shops throughout the state, and even more people are handy and can figure out how to fix things when they break. And Alaskans really value being able to take care of things themselves or rely on their local community as opposed to the global supply chain of stuff. When repair shops can't get the parts that they need or individual tinkerers can't get the right tool, it makes it harder for the business to make ends meet and breeds a culture of assuming replacement is the only option. So to summarize, this bill will demonopolize repair, which will help protect Alaska's air, water, and land. It will help Alaskans save money, and it will remove barriers to truly local economies that support the livelihood of Alaskans and that build resiliency in our state. The support for this legislation is incredibly broad. Pretty much everyone wants more options for getting their stuff fixed and the choice for who they want to go to. I've spoken with Alaskans from all political persuasions and many different communities about the issue, and essentially everyone is in support. Several states have passed legislation ranging from Texas to California, and most of the time these bills get close to unanimous support on the floor. Both the Trump administration and the Biden administration have expressed support as well. So I encourage you to support the bill and give Alaskans the freedom to fix their electronics locally.
Thank you very much, Ms. Chapman. Any questions from committee members? Thank you again for joining us.
Of course.
We'll go now to the Teams Hub, where we have Mr. Justin Castle. Mr. Castle, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and Senators. For the record, my name is Justin Castle. I'm the independent business owner of Eagle River Electronics here in Eagle River, Alaska. We're a business that repairs and services any electronics that we can. Recently, I wrote an op-ed to the Alaska Beacon attempting to spread awareness of the right to repair, including Senate Bill 111, and just my personal anecdotes on how it can affect real Alaskans, trying to highlight both the Senate and the House bills on the matter. The piece I wrote had a much bigger impact than I anticipated. I'm told that many of you have read it, so thanks first to all of you for giving my words your time and consideration, especially thanks to Senator Dunbar for inviting me to speak to this committee today. I would also like to thank Ms. Chapman for her hard work at the Alaska Environment, encouraging me to write my experience, and Claire of the Alaska Beacon for editing and publishing help. In my paper, I talked about three of my clients, members of my community who came to me for help, and I talked about how the lack of a right to repair meant that I could not help them. But my paper has gone beyond even that. People from all over the state have reached out to me to thank me for my article and share their stories. Regular people, just Alaskan citizens. I've got a newspaper here that was sent to me by a business owner in Juneau who wanted to express their sentiments. They had similar experiences and lost many clients because things couldn't be fixed in a straightforward manner. Many of my local citizens here in Eagle River thanked me for writing the article because they've seen firsthand how me as a business owner, and I take the stance to always help my community and encourage people to get repairs where possible. I had a person from Kodiak who told me that my article is such a stirring discussion topic amongst their group of friends. They also sent me their own local newspaper saying that everyone they talked to could agree and had personally experienced something similar. A farmer out in Palmer contacted me to tell me that John Deere's prohibition against the repairs of their tractors and other farming equipment has cost his business tens of thousands of dollars. I had a family from Fairbanks who sent me another newspaper to tell me they supported my article and they have concerns that the lack of a right to repair is destroying our environment and creating a throwaway society. Beyond just my local community, I've had more than a dozen people from all around the state reach out to me to thank me for writing the article, share their support, and even some of them shared their stories. People who read the article and it resonated with them so much that they looked my business up, reached out to me. They took extra steps to contact me and thank me for taking a stand for the right to repair. Since publishing that article, not one person has contacted me to say a single word against it. Now, each of these papers, I've got a handful of newspapers that have been sent to me from all throughout the state, and each one of them represents a person who was so touched by the words that I spread. I offered to pay each of these people for the newspaper, to pay for shipping it to me, but every single one of them refused. Every one of these papers was sent at some cost to that Alaskan citizen from different corners of the state. All of them simply wanted to support the right to repair, to thank me for my words and to show the impact that I had and their desire to pass Senate Bill 111. At first, I simply thanked them for a memento of how far my words had spread, but as more and more people reached out to me, I realized that it could have a better purpose. These papers that I have are physical evidence of the great citizens all around the state who stand for the right to repair and will take extra steps at personal expense to add their voices in support of the right to repair. Now, in the interim since I wrote that article, I've had some successes. I've had a cash counting machine brought to me by a local used car lot that we were able to successfully repair. I've had a pill counter brought to me by a pharmacy that we were able to make operational again. I've had like a snowblower's capacitors that blew out that we were successfully able to replace. All of these without any schematics, known parts list, or documented tool use, but they're close enough to my specialty that I was able to find a solution in spite of that. But I've had even more failures. A monitor display from a local business, a MacBook in use by a graphic designer, and a controller for a water heater. These are just some examples in this month of March alone of things I have been unable to fix because there is no right to repair. And it's because Samsung refuses to sell parts to a small business so they can lock in big businesses that aren't in Alaska. It's because Apple wants to lock software access behind arbitrary hardware IDs so that only they can restore full functionality to your device, even when there's no Apple store within hundreds of miles of many Alaskans. It's because Honeywell won't let anyone but their personal technicians fix things so they can reap all the profits of repair, even when they don't have a single authorized technician in the entire state of Alaska. Alaskan citizens notice the current laws that support big businesses at the expense of everyone else. Alaskan citizens don't like that. Alaskan citizens, in my experience, support the right to repair. Senate Bill 111 would require manufacturers to provide access to tools, parts, and documentation for electronics of all kinds to the general public, as well as things beyond electronics. Both repair shops like mine and independent citizens who want to work on their own property. Now, work on your own property, fixing things, making them work the way that we need them to. In my opinion, that's the Alaskan way, and it's the American way. That's why I believe the Senate should carefully consider Senate Bill 111. It's the right thing to do, not for the billionaires in charge of these international companies, but for real Alaskans all around the state. And thank you, committee, for your time and willingness to consider my words on Senate Bill 111.
Thank you very much, Mr. Castle. Are there any questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none brings Senate Bill 111 back before the committee. Are there any questions or committee discussion? Also online, joining us for questions, Mr. John Proctor from the Right to Repair Campaign Public Interest Research Group. Does the committee have any questions for Mr. Proctor? Mr. Proctor, I have a question. It was mentioned in testimony that other states have passed bills similar to this one. How is it that these large companies, John Deere, Samsung, others that were mentioned today, how are they able to comply with bills like this in their states?
Yeah, I mean, and it wasn't all one industry. Like they each had their own approach, and there's been now more than a dozen of these bills that have passed.
Mr. Proctor, I'm sorry I have to interrupt you. Could you please state your name and affiliation for the record before answering?
Sure. Yes, my name is Nathan Proctor. I am the senior director of the Right to Repair campaign for a nonprofit called the Public Interest Research Group, based out of Denver, Colorado. So each of these companies has their own compliance plan. And a lot of the opposition that they gave, like, for example, Apple was, fiercely opposed to the parts pairing language, which was just introduced to you. But they just released a new laptop, which is their, according to iFixit, the most fixable laptop they've ever produced or have produced since 2012. And all of the parts pairing, part swapping prohibitions that have existed in previous models are now resolved. They have a new tool called the Repair Assistant, and it figures out when you switch parts, it figures out what the new part is and updates the computer so that it works properly. So we've seen a lot of different things, but basically when the provisions are put in place, companies figure out how to enable the repair. And we've made a lot of progress, but there's definitely some companies, especially in the appliance space, who have not fully rolled out these programs or are limiting access to manuals and parts and other repair materials only to states that have passed these laws. So they will sell you some bushings for your dishwasher or whatever, but only if you live in Oregon or Minnesota. But not if you live in another state.
Fascinating. Thank you for that. Appreciate it. Any other questions from committee members? Senator Dunbar, do you have any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chair. Thank you for hearing the bill.
You betcha. All right. With that, we will set Senate Bill 111 aside for further consideration at a future meeting coming soon. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. We're back on the record. It's 3:01 p.m. Our last item for today is Senate Bill 185. With us to reintroduce the bill, we have my staff, Ms. Savea Bieber. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please put yourself on the record and begin your introduction of the bill.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Savea Bieber, staff to Senator Bjorkman. Thank you for hearing SB 185 today. Senate Bill 185 updates Alaska's insurance statutes to keep consistent with federal laws known as McCarran-Ferguson Act and Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, and to prohibit unfair methods of competition and deceptive practices. SB 185 modernizes Alaska's insurance laws by clarifying permissible rebate and discount practices, allowing health-related wellness incentives, banning misleading free insurance advertising, and granting the Division of Insurance rulemaking authority to implement these updates.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bieber. Are there any questions for committee members? This bill may look familiar to many of you, as you all have heard this in the esteemed Community and Regional Affairs Committee, which I am not on, but all of you are. Any questions? Members have in their packets a draft proposed committee substitute. May I have a motion, please?
Can we have a brief at ease?
Yes, brief at ease. On the record, it's 3:05 p.m. here in Senate Labor and Commerce. Members have a draft proposed CS in their packets. May I have a motion, please?
Yes, Chair Bjorkman. I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 185, version 34-Lima Sierra 0721/India.
Thank you. Is there any objection? I will object for purposes of explanation. Ms. Savea Bieber.
Changes to SB 185 from version N to version I are as follows. Sections 1 and 2 have no changes. Section 3 amends AS 2136110B1, requiring an insurer to ensure that the cost of a product or service does not exceed $250 for each policy term or 5% of the premium, and that the product or service is not only offered to an individual negotiating a group policy on behalf of others. There are no changes to sections 4 through 7, and section 8 amends the effective date from January 1st, 2026 to January 1st, 2027.
Are there any questions for Ms. Bieber about the draft proposed committee substitute? Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, just a comment. I appreciate integrating the conversation we had had earlier about preventing any sort of potentially illicit activity by providing benefits to folks who are negotiating on behalf of others. So thank you for putting that in the bill.
Very well. Any further questions? Seeing, hearing no further questions, is there further objection to the draft proposed committee substitute? Seeing, hearing none, I'll remove my objection and committee substitute version 34-LS0721/I as an igloo is before the committee as the working document. We have three invited testifiers on the phone to speak to the bill. First up is Ms. Laura Curtis. Ms. Curtis, could you please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony?
Good morning, or good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Laura Curtis, and I'm with the American Property Casualty Insurance Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate Bill 185, which modernizes Alaska's insurance laws relating to rebates, value-added products and services, and advertising practices. Alaska's anti-rebating statutes, like those in many states, were enacted more than a century ago to address improper incentives and solvency concerns. While well intentioned, these laws have not kept pace with modern insurance practices or consumer expectations. Today, insurance is not simply about paying claims after a loss. It is increasingly about preventing losses before they occur. Insurers now work in partnership with consumers to reduce risk, improve safety, and promote better outcomes. However, outdated and inconsistent anti-rebating rules can prevent insurers from offering practical tools that benefit consumers and reduce losses. SB 185 addresses this issue in a thoughtful and balanced manner. The bill allows insurers and insurance producers to offer value-added products and services that are related to insurance coverages, such as risk mitigation tools, safety training, and educational resources. At the same time, the bill preserves strong consumer protections and regulatory oversight. It requires that products and services be offered based on documented non-discriminatory criteria, and it maintains the application of existing privacy, consumer protection, and unfair trade practice laws. The Director of Division of Insurance retains clear authority to regulate these activities. SB 185 is consistent with reforms developed through the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, following a robust and inclusive process involving regulators, consumers, advocates, and industry stakeholders to amend the NAIC Unfair Practices Model Act. Since the NAIC amended the Model Act in 2020, over a dozen states have adopted legislation very similar to those proposed in SB 185. Adoption of this approach promotes consistency across states and helps eliminate the current patchwork of rules that hinder innovation. Examples of permitted offerings include water leak detection devices, driver safety training, risk prevention applications, and home inventory tools. Common sense solutions that help protect Alaskans and their property. Thank you for your time and consideration. I respectfully urge your support for Senate Bill 185.
Thank you very much, Ms. Curtis. Any questions for our committee members? Seeing, hearing none, we'll go next to Christian Rataj. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony. Are you on mute? Christian, we cannot hear you if you're talking.
Can you hear me now, sir?
Yes, we can. Thank you for joining us.
Sorry about that.
It's okay. I'm sure you were doing a great job.
Good afternoon, Chair, and honored members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. As you can see, I may sound like Kermit the Frog right now, and I apologize. I'm fighting a respiratory infection. I'm with the National Association of Mutual Insurance Companies, and we are pleased today to be testifying in support of Senate Bill 185. I agree with all of the comments made by my colleague from APCIA just a moment ago, but would also like to emphasize a few brief points. Senate Bill 185 is really a perfect example of how regulators, policymakers, and the insurance industry could come together to collaborate to promote pro-consumer legislation designed to help policymakers reduce their risk exposure. That's the key to keeping insurance available and affordable, is to reduce risk and prevent risk wherever possible. NAMIC would like to specifically thank Senator Bjorkman and the Department of Insurance for all of the work on this over the past 2 years. There's been a lot of discussion and a lot of hard work making sure that this legislation is reasonable and balanced and provides consumers with appropriate consumer protections while still helping facilitate cooperation between insurers and their policyholders in risk management. As Ms. Curtis had mentioned, for a number of years now, there's been a national movement toward modifying laws like Senate Bill 185 so that insurers can assist their policyholders in undertaking reasonable risk mitigation activities. As we all know from experience in today's inflationary world, the cost of everything is going up. So it's only reasonable that certain homeowners and insurance consumers struggle financially to undertake certain risk mitigation activities in their home. So being able to work with their insurance company to address this is essential and beneficial to everyone. NAMIC really appreciates the time that went into discussing some of the amendments on this bill. We think that this is, as Benjamin Franklin would say, appropriate because an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And this affords policyholders the opportunity to work with insurers on risk mitigation goods and services that they may not be able to get on their own, but they can with the assistance of the insurance company. Now, the bill protects policyholders by requiring, first of all, that there be regulatory oversight by the Department of Insurance. Second, it requires that it be expressly something that's provided to the policyholder at no cost to them. And then third, that the policyholder gets to retain the risk mitigation good or service even if they don't continue their professional relationship with the insurer. So we see this as a win-win bill that is good for everybody. Insurers benefit because insurers want to keep claims costs down because those get directly reflected into rates. And it's good for homeowners because no one wants to have a claims event in their home. As Ms. Curtis had mentioned, a couple of examples, water shutoff valves, devices that can evaluate and warn you that there might be electrical surge in your system. Those are all good for saving people's lives, saving their property, and improving the insurance marketplace. Now, we appreciate that there's an amendment that's been discussed about placing a cap on the value of that risk mitigation good or service. And we respect that and appreciate that and want to support this bill because it's a very important bill. We believe that that cap isn't really necessary because, first of all, the bill says that it has to be reasonable and related to the product, the insurance product, and the premium being paid. But more importantly, the Department of Insurance has regulatory oversight. We just want to make sure that there's nothing that really adversely impacts the practicality of this bill. And that way, if it just is tied to reasonableness as originally stated in the originally introduced legislation, it just gives more discretion to everyone to reap the benefit of modern technology for risk mitigation. But either way, we support the bill, and we greatly appreciate all the time and effort that went into this. We think it's a win-win, as I said, for all consumers and insurers. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Rataj. If you were here, we always have a eager supply of cough drops ready and waiting, and I wish I could give you one.
Thank you.
Very good. I have a question, either for yourself or Ms. Curtis, about kind of preventative items. Let's just say something I'm familiar with. If someone goes and they apply for some term life insurance. And that term life policy, the term life policy requires significant blood work or a physical or something. And the insurance company offers to pay for that service, for the blood work, the testing, the medical appointment. Would current law, without this bill, would current law allow an insurance company to do that?
This is Christine Rikaz. My association doesn't get involved into health insurance issues, so I'm not an expert on this issue. But at a conceptual level, the current law would arguably prevent that being provided because that could be considered to be a service or good that's rebated back to the policyholder who has received some value from that diagnostic service. The purpose of Senate Bill 185 is to address things like that, where when you look at it, it's crucial for the policyholder. There's nothing that's hanky-panky-ish, so to speak, or inappropriate about it. It really goes to the heart of what the relationship is about. It doesn't change any of the terms and conditions of the policy. It just assists the consumer in doing with what they need to do to get the benefit of the policy.
Very good. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions or comments from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, anything in wrap-up, Ms. Bieber? She says no, for the record. All right. Well, at this time, we will set Senate Bill 185 aside for further consideration at a future meeting. I'd like to continue just flagging that issue about the cap on rebates and wondering about the policy choice of putting that in statute or leaving that up to our very capable Division of Insurance Regulators to manage. So I think we can definitely recognize the concern there, but also if there's one thing we don't tolerate here in Senate Labor and Commerce, it's hanky-panky. So very good. Thank you, Mr. Rataj, for flagging that concern for us. The Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will meet again on Wednesday of this week when we will take up Senate Bill 225, Trusts, Trust Proceedings, and Trustees, Senate Bill 244, Travel Insurance, Senate Bill 35, Delivery Network Companies, Senate Bill 248, Genetic Counselors Licensing Advisory Clinics. Also, under bills previously heard, we can now notice the bill we heard before about homemade foods, Senate Bill 226, under bills previously heard for Wednesday. We'll add that to the schedule. It seems like a common sense change that we can take up then. But if you guys have concerns about that, let me know, and we can incorporate those into the committee schedule. So once again, Senate Bill 226, Homemade Food Reduced Oxygen Packaging, will be added to the schedule on Wednesday. As there is no further business to come before the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee today, we are adjourned at 3:20 p.m. Thank you.